morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Amy Howe, and I was appointed by this court to brief and argue this case as an amicus in support of the appellant, Mrs. Mary Richards. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case is about a mortgage that never should have been extended. Option one provided Mrs. Richards, who's an octogenarian with a poor credit history, with a loan whose monthly payments were nearly twice her monthly income, and it did that without making any attempt to verify that she could afford to make those payments. Not surprisingly, she was unable to make the payments, and as a result, she lost the home in which she had lived for over 40 years. What's extraordinary about this case is that the appellees in their brief that have literally nothing disputing our assertion that the mortgage was substantively unconscionable. That is, that it was characterized by terms that are unreasonably favorable to option one. If, for all of the reasons outlined in our briefs, you reject the argument that appellees offer to try to keep this court from considering the substantive unconscionability of the loan, I think it's important to be clear on that, that appellees really do not dispute that the loan was substantively unconscionable. And I believe that this case, in which the mortgage payments were nearly twice her monthly income, is sufficiently unconscionable, that sufficiently egregious, that there's no showing of
procedure. How much cash did she take out at the closing?
$38,000 was deposited into her
account. How large were the payments?
The payments were $1,747 a month.
Thank you, ma'am.
Her monthly income was $974 per month. So we think that this is sufficiently egregious that there's no showing of procedural unconscionability required. But in any event, the arguments that appellees offer to keep you from getting to the substantive unconscionability are simply straw men. First, Mrs. Richards did not waive her unconscionability argument. There was a statutory unconscionability argument in her complaint that was dismissed, but this court in the Williams versus First Mortgage Company case made clear that statutory unconscionability and common law unconscionability are two separate claims with different remedies and different tests. And Mrs. Richards, in count one of her complaint, which was not dismissed, alleges that the mortgage was unlawful because the payments were nearly twice her monthly income, which...
Would we be making a precedent that any time a person took a mortgage where the payments were more than their income, that's an unconscionable contract?
Certainly not, Chief Judge Sentell.
What would distinguish this from that case? Why would we not be making such a precedent?
Well, this court has made clear in cases like Williams versus First Mortgage that whether or not a loan is unconscionable is a highly fact-dependent inquiry, and so you have to prove both procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability. And I think that in this case, in which it's not simply more than her monthly income, but twice her monthly income, is sufficiently egregious that you wouldn't need to look at anything else. But in other cases,
really, you'd have to look at in the end, you'd have to look at the prior loan and the change of financial relationship as a result of substituting the new loan for the prior one.
Certainly.
I mean, an absolute minimum, that would be.
Certainly. And in this case, she had a reverse mortgage. So she went from receiving money from her prior mortgage company to having payments that were nearly twice her monthly income.
And how long was that going to go on? Do we know that?
I
don't think it's in what we have.
I don't know the answer to that.
No.
I'm not sure whether
that
that's in the record.
If that was about to come to an end, this might have been her best option.
She may have wanted the lump sum.
She may well have wanted the lump sum, and the reasons for that are not in the record.
Right,
but
and it is the norm that you can't make the other party responsible for you making a bad bargain.
I think that's right, certainly, Chief Judge Sentell, but I think we're focusing on whether or not it was substantively unconscionable, but there's nothing in the appellee's briefs that disputes our argument that it was substantively unconscionable.
But they don't have any burdens either.
No, that's certainly true, but they argue that we have waived the argument, which we have not. They argue that there's no cause of action.
Your argument depends entirely on paragraph 49 of the complaint.
That's
part of count one.
That is part of count one. And it's not, to be sure, Judge Williams, it's not stated with the utmost clarity, but I think that it's important if you look at the subsequent briefing in the case. In one of Mrs. Richards' subsequent briefs, after count seven, the statutory unconscionability argument was dismissed. She argued that, again, that the loan was unconscionable, which, again, may not be enough to get us over the mountain, but I think it's what is truly important for this court to recognize was that in its reply to that brief, The other side recognized that she was making an unconscionability argument, and they addressed it on its merits. They did not assert at that time that the argument is waived, and they're only asserting it now. So, you know, I don't think that there's an argument that that it's been waived. I believe that the appellee's argument that the common law unconscionability can only be asserted defensively is also belied by this court's decisions in the Williams versus First Mortgage Company case, the Urban Investments versus Branham case, and also a case called Isaac versus the First National Bank of Maryland case, which appears at 647 A. 2nd, 1159. It's an opinion of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. So that argument falls by the wayside. And then we're just left with the argument that Mrs. Williams has not contended that the loan was procedurally unconscionable. We believe that she does not have to argue that it's procedurally unconscionable because this loan is sufficiently egregious. But in any event, that there are...
What do you mean by procedurally unconscionable?
Sure, that is a shorthand that this court has used, that there are two prongs for common law unconscionability claims, whether or not there was an absence of meaningful choice, which is usually referred to as the procedural unconscionability prong.
Are they two prongs or are they two elements? Isn't it the norm that you have to establish both of them? It's not that there is a separate procedural and substantive unconscionability, is it? Isn't it that there have to be both unconscionable in its terms and that there has to be a lack of meaningful choice?
That is the normal case, yeah, in the District of Columbia, but the District of Columbia Court of Appeals in the Bennett case made clear that there may well be cases in which one prong or the other persists particularly.
Have they ever found one where they said it was enough?
I was not able to locate one, Chief Justice.
Kenyon, I think, is the one that I saw the phrase in, and that was dicta, and Bennett's dicta, isn't it? So they've never yet run into that animal. There may be one out. There may be a purple cow, but they haven't found one.
There may be one out there, Chief Judge Sentell, that I was not able to locate either. But I believe that, you know, this is that case in which the monthly payments were twice her monthly income, and option one made no effort, even though it knew that she was elderly and had a poor credit history.
Didn't
to verify
she have
that.
A younger relative with her throughout this whole process? Or
she did, Your Honor. Her attorney, right, in fact, Ms. Raymond.
Right. She had her attorney, in fact, with her. And there are plenty of other lending companies out there in the world. I mean, it's not like she had no meaningful choice. Isn't it a bit hard to make this into a purple cow? You've done a magnificent job of trying.
Thank you, Chief Judge. I appreciate that. I mean, the absence of meaningful choice, although appellees argue that she needed to demonstrate that there was no other option available to her, this court has made clear that, and other courts as well, that part of the absence of meaningful choice is whether or not there was a gross inequality of bargaining power. And we would submit that certainly is present here. You've got a, you know, billion-dollar corporation on one hand and an octogenarian who's in poor health and has a poor credit history on the other side. The court has no further questions. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Morning, counsel.
May it please the court, Patrick Buckler on behalf of Option One Mortgage Corporation, now known as Sand Canyon Corporation. The fundamental problem with the arguments raised by
amicus... Operating under an assumed name now, are you?
it's a new entity, Your Honor. And the reason being is that the some of the assets from the company were sold to a different company, and some of the assets remain with the old entity. But in any event, the fundamental problem with the arguments raised by amicus is that they were never raised below. Mary Richards, who was represented by counsel in the district court, never made mention of procedural or substantive unconscionability. The parties never briefed those issues, and those issues do not appear in the district court's memorandum opinion. Additionally, Richards never opposed the motions for summary judgment filed by Gross and Option One on the grounds that Ms. Richards did not receive the notice of foreclosure sale and would not have understood the notice if she had received it. To suggest that those issues were somehow raised and preserved is really disingenuous. Even assuming this court decides to consider the arguments of amicus, it is still clear that the district court properly granted summary judgment in favor of Option One and Gross. First, unconscionability cannot be used as an affirmative cause of action here, and there are no facts in the record to suggest that go to the issues of procedural and substantive unconscionability. Second, issues of whether Richards failed to receive notice of the foreclosure sale and whether she would have understood such a notice are irrelevant and immaterial under the law of the District of Columbia, which only requires a showing of compliance with the procedures set forth in D.C. Code Section 42.815b. Richards' sole unconscionability claim was asserted pursuant to Count 7 of her complaint, which was based on the District of Columbia Consumer Protection Procedures Act. Now, Richards, for whatever reason, dismissed this action with this claim with prejudice pursuant to a joint stipulation of dismissal. And under these circumstances, Richard clearly waived the only unconscionability claim she had, and Amica should be precluded from raising any arguments related to the issue of unconscionability on this appeal. In its opinion, the district court recognized that Richard had alleged in her complaint that she did not receive notice of the foreclosure sale that is required by statute, but went on to hold that she now has essentially conceded this point and does not pursue it in her opposition, other than to state that Richards did not recall receiving notice. Thus, in her oppositions to the motions for summary judgment, Richard failed to present any argument against the imposition of summary judgment on the grounds that Amicus now asserts for the first time on appeal, i.e., that Ms. Richards did not receive the notice of the foreclosure and would have not understood the foreclosure or would not have understood the notice if she had received it. Rather, the arguments of Richards, who had the benefit of counsel in the district court, centered on her contention that option one failed to provide a payoff statement and wrongly prevented her new lender, Countrywide, from tendering payoff of the entire balance so as to cure her prior default. Amicus now apparently abandons those arguments and attempts to raise new arguments that Richards did not have actual notice of the foreclosure sale and would not have understood the notice even if it had been received. Amicus simply cannot raise these arguments, which were not raised by Richards in the trial court below. Under the common law, a court can do no more than refuse enforcement of an unconscionable section or sections of a contract, but cannot award either restitution or money damages. Indeed, the case law cited by Amicus in her brief demonstrates that unconscionability at common law is utilized defensively. While Richards did pursue an affirmative unconscionability claim through her District of Columbia Consumer Protection Act claim, she elected to dismiss that claim, and it cannot now be resurrected. Even if this court recognized such an unconscionability claim fashioned by Amicus, the record is devoid of any evidence that Richards lacked a meaningful choice when she chose her mortgage broker, when she chose her lender, and ultimately when she entered into the mortgage transaction at issue. Indeed, the record is devoid of many facts that would have a bearing on the issue of unconscionability. As recognized in the cases cited by Amicus, it is usually difficult to determine from the four corners of the contract whether the terms are unconscionable. The commercial setting, purpose, and effect of the contract must be considered and thus established through extrinsic evidence. Those criteria were never addressed by Richards, and thus the district court could make no findings with respect to those criteria. Procedural and substantive unconscionability were simply never raised below. Now, with respect to the notice of the foreclosure sale, significantly, Amicus does not argue or otherwise contest the undisputed fact that option one absolutely complied with the foreclosure notice procedures. Furthermore, Amicus acknowledges that the controlling law in this jurisdiction provides that actual notice of a foreclosure sale is not required if the statutory requirements are adhered to, which they were. The holdings in SG Investment and Young are clear that whether or not Richards received actual notice or would have understood it have absolutely no relevance or materiality to the issues in this case. In other words, once it was established
that our rules suggest against reading arguments to us, counsel, if you want to perhaps condense and comply.
Yes, Your Honor. So with regard to the issue of the notice requirement, the notice requirements were satisfied. The case law that the Amicus cites indicates that it would have been better if there were actual notice, but actual notice isn't required by the D.C. Code. And so for the reasons with regard to unconscionability and also with regard to the foreclosure notice, we believe that this court should affirm the district court's granting of summary judgment in this case. Thank you.
Unless my colleagues have questions. Thank you, counsel. We'll, how much time do you have left?
1 minute.
Give her 2 full minutes for rebuttal.
I have just 3 points. The first is that, again, as in their briefs, the appellees have made no effort to defend the loan that it made to Ms. Richards. The second is that, once again, although, is that they, in their briefs, in reply to one of Ms. Richards' briefs in opposition to summary judgment, they acknowledged that she was making an unconscionability argument, and they defended it on the merits, even though in the same brief they accused her of raising another argument for the first time in that brief. And finally, once again, I'd like to point this court to its precedent holding that, acknowledging that common law unconscionability can be raised as an affirmative claim, as in the Williams case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Let me ask you just again briefly, what basis would there be for saying she had no meaningful choice?
I do believe that there was gross inequality of bargaining power, which has been recognized as one element of...
That argument seems to be really extraordinary, because that would seem to mean that no large corporation can make a loan to a poor person, which is surely highly disadvantageous for poor people.
Well, I think it wasn't simply that she was poor. She was elderly, she was in poor health, and she
can't
had
make
a poor credit.
To an elderly person in poor health.
Parts of this panel are very concerned about elderly people.
I just to give you a little bit of comfort, Judge Wentz, I mean, each of these is highly fact-specific, and so I think that holding that there was gross inequality of bargaining power in this case would certainly be not setting a precedent for all poor people.
We would have to say what it is that makes it that she has no meaningful choice. I know it's fact-specific, but we can't just say it's fact-specific. We have to mention what facts it is that's specific to in this case, and I don't know how we do that without making a really pernicious precedent if we say that simply because there's an inequality of bargaining power. Almost inherently, there's an inequality of bargaining power. Even if you're not a poor person, you're not a billion-dollar bank.
I don't think, Chief Judge Santel, that you need to reach this question, because I believe that this is actually the rare case
in which the
substantive unconscionability is so egregious that you don't need to reach that question.
Where's the option one brief acknowledging that an unconscionability argument has been made?
It's cited in my reply brief, Your Honor.
Is it in the JA?
It is not in the JA, I apologize. But it is cited in my brief at pages 5 to 6. And these are briefs that were filed well after count 7, the statutory unconscionability claim, was dismissed with prejudice.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, we thank you for taking on the task of amicus for the unrepresented litigant at this stage. The court appreciates your efforts on behalf of the bench and the bar of the United States.
Thank you, Chief Judge Santel.